This episode of the Children's Literature Podcast is brought to you by The First Sunburn of Summer. The First Sunburn of Summer. Hopefully the last one as well. Welcome to the Children's Literature Podcast. I'm your host, TQ Townsend. This episode is about Casey at the Bat. For me, summertime means going to the beach, trying to eat popsicles before they melt, and playing baseball. I'm not much of a fan of watching ball on TV, but I love seeing games live. Any game. The Dodgers, a little league team, the Dodgers, a minor league team, the Dodgers, or the Dodgers. I also love playing in those nice, friendly neighborhood games where the rules are a little bit relaxed and it's more about having a nice time than winning. So it'll come as no surprise that I also love the poem Casey at the Bat by Ernest Thayer. Before we look at this wonderful little piece of American poetry, I wanted to remind you that the 100th episode is coming up, and co-host Chloe and I will be taking your questions as we did for the 50th episode. Ask us anything. Send your questions to letters at childrensliteraturepodcast.com. For over 100 years, Casey at the Bat has been one of America's best-known and best-loved poems. But in recent decades, it's started to slip from common knowledge. If you and your kids need some fun summer reading, I recommend dusting off this classic. It's short and sweet and makes a great selection for children who need a poem to memorize for English class or a speech club event. The full title of the poem is Casey at the Bat, A Ballad of the Republic, sung in the year 1888. If that seems a bit over the top, that's because it is. This is a comic bit of verse that satirizes the pretentious, heavy-handed poetry that was trendy back in the 19th century. It uses language that imitates themes in classic literature, but it's just about a baseball game. It was first published in 1888 in a San Francisco paper called The Daily Examiner, and it was an instant hit. This poem beautifully describes the agony that sports fans feel when their team loses, while also giving a good warning to readers about how dangerous it is to be overconfident. There are many recordings of Casey at the Bat available, and here's my own recitation, which I'll also post to my YouTube channel in case you need a version to play in class. Ideally, though, you'll get your kids to perform it for themselves. I've previously mentioned Mark Twain's essay, How to Tell a Story, and I would say that his good advice about how to deliver a humorous American tale applies here. When reciting this poem, it's very important to be completely earnest, acting as if you had no idea that what you were saying is funny at all. The outlook wasn't brilliant for the Mudville Nine that day. The score stood 4-2, with but one inning more to play. And then when Cooney died at first and Barrows did the same, a sickly silence fell upon the patrons of the game. A straggling few got up to go in deep despair. The rest clung to that hope which springs eternal in the human breast. They thought if only Casey could get but a whack at that, they'd put up even money now, with Casey at the bat. But Flynn preceded Casey, as did also Jimmy Blake, and the former was a Lulu and the latter was a cake. So upon that stricken multitude grim melancholy sat, for there seemed but little chance of Casey's getting to the bat. But Flynn let drive a single to the wonderment of all, and Blake, the much despised, tore the cover off the ball. And when the dust had lifted, and the men saw what had occurred, there was Jimmy safe at second, and Flynn a-huggin' third. Then from 5,000 throats and more there rose a lusty yell, It rumbled through the valley. It rattled in the dell. It knocked upon the mountain and recoiled upon the flat. For Casey, mighty Casey, was advancing to the bat. There was ease in Casey's manner as he stepped into his place. There was pride in Casey's bearing and a smile on Casey's face. And when, responding to the cheers, he lightly doffed his hat, no stranger in the crowd could doubt 'twas Casey at the bat. 10,000 eyes were on him as he rubbed his hands with dirt. 5,000 tongues applauded when he wiped them on his shirt. Then while the writhing pitcher ground the ball into his hip, defiance gleamed in Casey's eye. A sneer curled Casey's lip. And now the leather-covered sphere came hurtling through the air, and Casey stood a-watching it in haughty grandeur there. Close by the sturdy batsman, the ball unheeded sped.
"That ain't my style," said Casey.
"Strike one,"
the umpire said. From the benches, black with people, there went up a muffled roar, like the beating of the storm waves on a stern and distant shore.
"Kill him! Kill the umpire!"
shouted someone on the stand. And it's likely they'd have killed him, had not Casey raised his hand. With a smile of Christian charity, great Casey's visage shone. He stilled the rising tumult. He bade the game go on. He signaled to the pitcher, and once more the spheroid flew. But Casey still ignored it, and the umpire said,
"Strike two!"
"Fraud!" cried the maddened thousands, and echo answered fraud. But one scornful look from Casey, and the audience was awed. They saw his face grow stern and cold, they saw his muscles strain, and they knew that Casey wouldn't let that ball go by again. The sneer is gone from Casey's lip. His teeth are clenched in hate. He pounds with cruel violence his bat upon the plate. And now the pitcher holds the ball, and now he lets it go, and now the air is shattered by the force of Casey's blow. Oh, somewhere in this favored land, the sun is shining bright. The band is playing somewhere, and somewhere hearts are light. And somewhere men are laughing, and somewhere children shout. But there is no joy in Mudville. Mighty Casey has struck out. This poem can be read at school or at home for just a bit of fun, but it can also serve as a nice introduction to some very important literary concepts. Most of the poetic elements are used to help make it more funny because they're just too grandiose for the subject matter. For example, the second stanza has an enjambment, where the sentence breaks at the end of a line and picks up at the beginning of the next one. Shakespeare did this frequently in his plays, and so did John Milton when writing Paradise Lost, the most highbrow poem ever written in English. By using a style of poetry normally associated with cataclysmic, universe-altering events, Ernest Thayer was gently and good-naturedly teasing sports fans who can truly feel the world is ending when their team loses. Younger readers will need help understanding the symbolism and vocabulary used in Casey at the Bat. As long as a child knows a little about baseball, it'll be easy to understand the overall meaning of the poem. That gives some sort of platform to stand on when trying to learn about the satirical poetic language. Mudville 9 is a straightforward reference to the number of players on a baseball team, but terms like spheroid, fraud, and haughty grandeur might be unfamiliar to a younger kid. Anyone who's ever been to a baseball game will not require an explanation for the phrase, "kill the umpire." There are a lot of figures of speech in Casey at the Bat, and you can send your students hunting for examples of hyperbole, personification, metaphors, and similes. Even the term Mudville 9 can be used to explain the idea of a kenning,
a poetic device that shows up often in Old Norse poetry. If you're about to teach some literature from ancient Greece to your class, Casey at the Bat would be a good thing to read beforehand to explain the concept of hubris. It's very difficult to understand the morality of ancient Greece without knowing this term. Hubris isn't just pride. It's sinful, intentional, unpardonable pride. It's when someone is so arrogant that when their inevitable fall comes, all you can do is throw your hands up and say, "Well, what did you think was going to happen?" Another classical connection comes from the deliberate capitalization of the word echo, referring to the nymph from Greek myths. Casey's built up as a heroic figure in the poem. He's called Mighty Casey, and his visage is described as shining. It's sarcastic, of course, but the language is meant to make you think of figures like Achilles or Hercules. The preceding players are described as a lulu and a cake, which means not good, and so all the hopes of the fans in the stands are placed in Casey. And then he blows it. So sure of his own victory, Casey doesn't even swing at the first two pitches. He just lets them go by. This is where a little knowledge of baseball is important. When Casey comes up to bat, he has to hit the ball. If he gets out, the game is over and the Mudville Nine will lose. At the very least, he's got to get on base so that the game can continue. Ideally, he'll hit a home run, knocking in the two other players and winning the game. In baseball, three strikes means you're out. A strike can happen for several reasons, but one of them would be for failing to swing at a perfectly good pitch. In this situation, Casey shows supreme hubris by throwing away his first two chances, declaring, "That ain't my style." Even when the crowd initially gets angry at the umpire, thinking that perhaps a bad call has been made, Casey raises his hand to indicate that no, everything's fine. He intentionally lets two chances to save the day go right by him, leaving everything to the final pitch. And he misses. Casey lets down himself, his team, and all 5,000 Mudville fans because of his arrogant overconfidence. As useful as Casey at the Bat is for teaching about literary devices, you can also just take the poem literally. If you're coaching a little league team, it provides a great way to explain the rules and talk about what players should do in such a situation. You have to decide what to do during those moments in sports where everlasting glory or eternal heartbreak will descend upon you as the last play of the game unfolds. These are times that us sports fans will relive and relitigate for years. I've had delightful arguments over the final moments of basketball games, football games, baseball games, decades after they ended. And that's why this poem is so beloved. It perfectly captures the kind of sports moment that fans live for. If Casey had knocked that last pitch over the fences, he would have ascended to the heavens as a sports god for all time. And in Mudville, there would be a statue of him in the town square to this day. But he whiffed it, bringing shame to his name and desolation to a population. But at least for all time, Mudville fans would be able to debate Casey's performance at the plate. Should he have swung at those first two pitches? Were they actually no good and that useless ump made bad calls? What went wrong with that last pitch? Why didn't he connect? What would have happened if he did? Casey at the Bat is the kind of legend that's unfolded in every town where baseball's ever been played, and one that deserves the place it's held in the hearts of baseball fans for 135 years. I hope that you and your kids will join in that long tradition by reading Casey at the Bat this summer. You've been listening to the Children's Literature Podcast. Please subscribe and give the show a rating. Send comments to letters@childrensliteraturepodcast.com. I'm your host, TQ Townsend. Thanks for listening.